Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions World Headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. So far this year, 2023 has been an active one for the horror genre. The year is only a third of the way over, and there have been releases aplenty. Some of them, like Evil Dead Rise, have been big at the box office, and most have not. But theatrical release is a tough ride for genre movies, especially the independent ones. The familiar titles, or what the industry loves to call IP for intellectual property, are what feed the big screen most successfully, and every original horror film that dies at the box office is another nail in the coffin of original horror movies at the cinema. But the evolution that continues at such a high rate means that streaming has replaced the drive-in and the independent theaters and art houses. So it just means that you have to search. Podcasts and websites that bring attention to horror movies are plentiful and provide an opportunity to discover these little gems that you might never have seen without their help. There is no community like the horror community for word-of-mouth information, and the discourse, though often rowdy, is filled with varying opinions of varying bloviations. You soon learn which of these voices coincides most closely with your own opinion. I'd love to hear what you think of what's come so far this year. Titles like Megan, Infinity Pool, Scream 6, Evil Dead Rise, The Pope's Exorcist, Skinamarink, Knock at the Cabin, Wasera, The Bone Woman, Swallowed, There's Something Wrong with the Children, Renfield, Winnie the Pooh, Blood and Honey, and all the other titles out there. Send us your thoughts to our email address, askmickanything@gmail.com, and let's see what you love and what you don't. Our returning champion on this episode is none other than Tom Holland, screenwriter of Psycho 2, writer-director of Fright Night and Child's Play, and actor in The Stand. It's been a while since he's been on the slab, and it's definitely time to catch up. This episode is sponsored by the new sci-fi thriller, The Artifice Girl, written and directed by Franklin Rich and featuring the legendary Lance Henriksen. When a team of special agents stumbles upon an AI designed to trap predators, they soon find it rapidly advancing beyond its original purpose. The Artifice Girl is now playing in selected theaters, on demand, and digital. Tom Holland, welcome back to Postmortem.
Mick Garris, thank you for having me. It's just terrific to be here, especially on the 40th anniversary of Child's Play 2, and Psycho 2, and yeah. You did Psycho 4.
So it's a party.
Yeah, it's a party, and there are no dolls around.
It's
Norman,
a psycho
Norman.
Party. Yeah, it's a psycho party. It's very weird being the last remaining director of the Psycho quadrilogy. Very bizarre feeling. But I want to also, before we get too deep into the psycho world, I want to talk about your beginnings as an actor, because that's something that never gets discussed. And you did so much of it. You made your living. You were a working actor before you were writing Psycho 2.
Oh, yeah. Usually nobody is particularly interested. Thank you, Mick.
Well, I think it's great. I mean, you were on all these classic TV shows like 77 Sunset Strip and all these things that happened when I was a child. And when we were children. Yeah. But I'm fascinated to know about what that world was like, because the world of television and film has changed so much from a director's perspective. But as an actor, I'm interested in what your experience was like in the 1960s and 70s in television and film.
Oh, my gosh. That's a whole episode all on its own. I started being good in high school, you know, in a play, and the drama instructor got me a job apprenticing at the Bucks County Playhouse in Bucks County, Pennsylvania, which is one of the pre-Broadway tryout playhouses. It's an important one. And that was my first experience in the business. And I don't remember particularly being interested in acting as much as I was just fascinated by film. But there was nowhere to go then. I'm talking about, oh my gosh, maybe I'm talking about 1960. I don't know, maybe 59.
You were in a theater community, so you were really out of touch with the cinematic world.
Well, there was no cinematic world available to me. I'm from mid-state New York farm country, a very small town called Highland, New York, which is not so small anymore. But there was nobody that I knew or in the family or anything like that about Hollywood or movies.
Well, how did you get that first screen role then? You were working in theaters that would lead to Broadway shows, but how did you make that transition to working actor?
From the Bucks County Playhouse, I learned about acting teachers in New York City. I was working and clerking in a woman's store owned by my family, and during the weekend, I went into New York and went to acting classes on Saturday, and from that experience, I learned about agents going out on auditions. TV commercials, and somehow I got into that world enough of it. It was my first summer before going away to Northwestern University, where I had gotten into the theater school. But that I got in there and I got into Carnegie Tech, but Carnegie had absolutely no academics, so I went to Northwestern, and then I went my first summer. After my first year in college, I got a 7-year contract to Warner Brothers, Mick.
How did that happen? How did you go from stage to a 7-year contract at Warner Brothers?
Well, because this sounds vain, but I was attractive physically, and
you're a handsome guy, Tom.
Thank you, but I look like what was on TV at that moment. And what was on TV was the last gasp of all the Western series, which had come as a reaction to the advent of television, which started with the Dumont Network, I think, in 1947 or 48. And that had totally destroyed the distribution system that the theaters, that the movies depended on. And then they got really ripped in 1968 by Robert Kennedy. With the, you know, the non, because they had a monopoly with the, right. They had the theaters as well as the studios. And then MCA bought Universal. So now all of a sudden you had your agents producing, which is what's going on right now, or what went on at the WGA in the last turnaround.
The Writers Guild. But at that time, MCA was the largest talent agency in Hollywood.
Yes.
And Lou Wasserman was the head. And so when MCA merged with or bought Universal, I don't know if it was a merger or a purchase, suddenly it became a vertical organization where the people who were hiring were also the people who were doing the selling to them.
Yes, the people who were representing the talent were also employing the talent.
Exactly.
That's called monopoly.
Exactly.
And they tried it again. And, you know, and that's the history of Hollywood that probably very few except us are interested in. But Wasserman and that whole experience explains the Psycho series and how the credits ended up at Universal, because Wasserman was Hitchcock's agent. Okay. And Wasserman brought him over from Paramount, I think.
Yeah. Psycho was a Paramount picture originally.
Originally. Yeah. And what happened was, the whole history of how they ended up with the Psycho legacy. You know, I've been doing research on. I put together a photo book with my memories on Child's Play,
right?
And I started through that. I met a very, very talented documentary maker in Australia named Mark Hartley.
Oh, and Mark is brilliant.
You know him?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, here's what happened. This is
almost
like,
Hollywood and
yes,
and Fire Maiden.
Yeah. Just terrific, huge fun. But it's also what was shocking to me. It was the last video appearance of Richard Franklin, who
right.
directed Psycho.
Two.
Yes, and I wrote the script for him. And it's the only experience I've ever had like that, working with the director as a writer.
And Richard Franklin was a really talented Australian director who was a total devotee of Alfred Hitchcock. But how did you go from working actor to the writer of the screenplay? Was your first script, as if I'm not mistaken?
No, The Beast Within was my first movie.
Ah, which I did publicity on when it came
out. Yeah!
We'll get into that later.
That got buried in the wreckage of United Artists when it crashed with the Western.
Heaven's Gate. Yeah.
Heaven's Gate.
Yeah.
And that was the Beast Within was the last release of UA before it crashed. It made money, but nobody knew about it because everything was about Heaven's Gate.
Right.
If you remember, they wrote at least one book on it that was very well known.
And I actually did publicity on the Filmex screening of Heaven's Gate at the Chinese Theater.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
It was bad.
Well, the stories, you know, they're like, I can't believe them.
Yeah, but we need to go back to Psycho 2 first. We're celebrating 40 years.
Let me tell you what Mark Hartley did. He had the last videotape interview with Richard Franklin, who was dying of prostate cancer.
Right.
And I had gone through that at the beginning of it with him and recommending doctors and blah, 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 surgeons, chemo. And he went back to Australia and did it with chemo there. A mistake. Anyway, there he was on this documentary, and then Mark Hartley sent me Richard's unpublished autobiography.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And Richard was terribly talented and volatile.
Really? I didn't see that side of him. I didn't know.
Well,
that.
the best experience I ever had and where he was absolutely wonderful and spot on was Psycho 2.
Yeah.
And then it started to go a little bit off kilter with Cloak and Dagger, which was the next one I wrote for him. But anyway, anyway, he's talking, and this is just the last month or 6 weeks, I'm reading his vision of a version of what happened with Psycho 2 from the time that he hired me and all the way through production. And it's just I've got to figure out a way of getting that information out to the fans who might be interested in the Psycho series.
Yeah. Well, how did he know about you? He says, how did you come into the picture?
He says in his memory that I was recommended to him by our mutual lawyer, who was Peter Deckham, who was still active, who's absolutely brilliant too. But then Richard read a spec screenplay that I had written called The Crystal Tower, and absolutely loved it. And he says in his autobiography that he interviewed 15 different writers.
Wow.
And so I got it, and I met with him, and I guess we got along or whatever. And I had this extraordinary experience of maybe 6 to 8 weeks where I wrote it. And, you know, I don't remember who did what. I did Mother with the Shovel. That was me, I found out. But he came into it with a vision because he was such a devotee of Hitchcock and had known him. He'd had Hitchcock down to USC for a graduate program down there. He'd also been on the set of I forget what it was, Topaz, Torn Curtain, I can't remember. Working with Richard was like having a graduate seminar, you know, at USC or something. That's where he was from, USC. He was a contemporary of Randall Kleiser.
Right. And Joel Schumacher and all.
Well, I was a contemporary of Joel Schumacher. Joel was older than I, but I knew Joel in New York. We worked together in New York, and I was an AD in a play at the Amazon, and Joel was the costumer.
Yeah, I knew there was a relationship there. And
yeah.
That's great.
Well, anyway, so I got into acting, and I had to go to court to be able to sign the 7-year contract. And so I was 19 or 20, and I kept at it. I did soaps in New York, which up to that point was the most money I'd ever made. I started out with a lot of people who are now incredibly famous. I did episodic with Harrison Ford.
Wow.
Yeah. And the first play I did in New York, there was a young Italian kid who was a brilliant actor, and his name was Al Pacino. That was his name. So I have stories along the way. But what happened was, directors would direct me, and in my head I would say, no, that's not the blocking to make it work. And I started to realize in those days it was about hit your marks because of the lights. The lights were there for your marks. So you'd have a two or three lines you'd have to say, and you'd make a move. And you'd make a move to hit the second area that was lit for the scene.
So it was a traffic cop job.
Well, yeah, but I don't think at the time that I knew that, because I was just so thrilled to be working. But I started to learn that there was a difference even in terms of the way the dramatic scenes were blocked and how to make them work. And I was in the actor's studio, and they had, this was 67 or 68 through 71 or two before I lost interest, I think.
So for the audience, the actor's studio was where method acting came from. The idea of living a part and being the part rather than approaching it from the outside in, it's from the inside out.
That's right. And we could David Mamet hates it.
Yeah.
It was all this. I got into the playwrights unit at the actor studio as an actor, where I was doing actors for writers who were writing one act plays. And they were writers who were mainly working in television, but some of them were having success in features, like Jim Bridges. Uh-huh. I knew Jim since forever.
Yeah, the China Syndrome, among others.
And paper cut. The one about lawyers.
Oh, Paper Chase.
Hey, yeah. Paper Chase.
Yeah, terrific movie. Yeah.
But I started somehow directing the scenes that other writers were writing in the actor's studio. And I would be in them, but I would also cast them, and I would block them. And God help me, but the scenes worked better.
So you were learning how to direct from a stage perspective.
How to direct actors. Yes, that. But I really started to learn it for film by acting, and because I was a film actor, basically. I think I did a couple of summers of summer stock and one of winter stock. But I was once I came to Hollywood and got in the Actors Studio, it was all about film. You know, yeah, there was they did stage plays, but the emphasis was really on film.
Right. I mean, you have a 7-year contract with Warner Brothers, so you were working a lot as a working actor under contract. Could you tell the difference between the different directors in doing television and features and the work that you did on the lot there?
Yes. Yes. Some were marginally more inventive than others. But I mean, there was sort of you did not question a director's choice in a television show. Maybe if you were the lead, you know, but right.
What were your favorite parts that you had during that era?
Well, I think that the favorites would be the soaps I did out of New York.
Really? And that was live TV then?
That was live TV where if you didn't nail it, if the flats came down, you kept on moving anyway, because it went, there was like a half hour or an hour time delay, and then it went to the West Coast out of there. But upstairs was Dark Shadows.
Oh, yeah.
Dan Curtis.
Yeah.
And that was just beginning. And General Hospital started there too at ABC, I think on West 67th Street or something. And I learned a ton about acting and acting for the camera there because there was time. You know, you started to work with whatever camera went with a red light. There were three cameras always, you know, but all of that so I didn't get a formal education. What was happening, I was getting it by work.
Which is a lot better way to learn.
Well, especially if you're able to make a few bucks at it.
Yes.
You know, but I wanted to write, and then I wanted to write and direct because that's what I saw around me at the Actors Studio in the Playwrights Unit. That's where I met Stuart Stern. That's where I met Paul and Joanne Newman. I mean, you know, it's a whole lifetime that went on. I'm sure you have the same stories.
I didn't come out of acting school. I didn't come out of performing. I came out of being a singer in a rock and roll band. But I started as a writer at age 12.
And okay.
That was my passion, was writing. And I loved movies and I loved the genre, but I loved all kinds of movies. And everything came from writing for me. And writing and loving movies and watching movies and doing publicity and being allowed to be on the set and watch a movie be made. That was my education. Amazing stories where you directed one of the episodes.
I still remember you taking in and introducing me to Richard Matheson.
Ah, yes.
Yes.
The great Richard Matheson.
Wow.
Well, that was my first job that I was paid as a writer. Was on Amazing Stories. I literally went from food stamps to writing for Steven Spielberg. And that's where I met you and so many of the other amazing filmmakers I got to know during that period. But that was my film school. All of those years you worked as an actor, that was my film school, was put into two seasons of Amazing Stories.
Uh-huh.
Being on the sets with Steven Spielberg and Bob Zemeckis and Joe Dante and Martin Scorsese and all these people who were directing episodes that I had written. Thanks.
Yeah. Thrilling, right?
Thrilling.
Thrilling. Thrilling.
So tell me about making that transition. You have a lucrative career as an actor. You're living a life you didn't expect to live in beautiful Southern California. And was it a decision to put that behind you and gamble with the life of a screenwriter, or was it a transition that took time?
It was a slow transition where I tried to back it up. I kept on working as an actor all the way through 1982, which is the same year that Psycho 2 came out. But I got a job on Winds of War for Dan Curtis in playing a submarine captain, you know, and I did that for like three days, but I was still making money from it years later. So I didn't really stop acting, but I stopped the monomaniacal pursuit of it. Uh-huh. And instead that pursuit turned to writing. I tried writing long form prose, and I could not make a novel. I could make short stories, but not novels. And I started writing screenplays because it was happening around me. All those people were writing screenplays at the Actor's Studio and became a social group, people that I knew. And I started writing screenplays, and I was a lot better at that. Hmm. I had a real visual sense. By that point, I had a sense of cutting and moving it and a lot of different things. And then I just got better and better at it. And I really started, well, I mean, I broke through in television with Initiation of Sarah, which was a hot TV movie.
A very hot TV movie that was known for its European version.
Yes, it was. It was known for its wet T-shirt scene, too.
Yeah, this was a genre film for television, network TV. But in the European version, they had added some nudity to it.
Yes.
So it became very well known because of that. And it's historical because it's good, but also because of that element.
They've remade that two or three times, Mick.
Amazing. I hope you got paid each time.
Well, if I did, it was so little, I don't remember it.
I know that feeling, Hocus Pocus too.
Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry.
Anyway, so that was The Beast Within. That was your first produced screenplay. Was it a spec script or was it an assignment?
No, I guess it was an assignment. I went in and I met with Harvey Bernhardt, the producer, now no longer with us.
Also, who did The Omen and lots of
Watchmen. Yeah, The Omen films. And he had bought a title called The Beast Within. And what he wanted to do was he wanted to take a teenager and turn her from a teenager into a beast. And the writer was getting a divorce and had never written it beyond the beyond like a page of a proposal. And So The Beast Within is an original, but I didn't get original credit for it. I didn't know enough in those days, but I was the only writer on it. I thought that would give me a hand up, and finally it would start. I had been starving since about 1974 through about 1978 or 9. I had a good 5 years in there where things were really tight.
Ooh. You know. But you dug out of that hole. Here's this movie, The Beast Within, which, like I said, I did publicity on that, and I was in Mississippi for part of that shoot.
Oh, my gosh.
And it was an amazing experience. And
I want to hear the story sometime. I had no idea. That's Philippe Mora directing.
Yeah, Philippe Mora, a very talented director who'd done a documentary called Brother, Can You Spare a Dime?
That's right, which was excellent. And he's a sweet man.
Really opened things up for him. He also did Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf. or was it Howling 3? I think it's 2. But a very talented guy and a sweet guy. But so your first movie is a genre film. Were you drawn to the genre originally, or it was just what was offered to you?
They were the entry-level jobs, Mick. Yeah. And at that point in time, horror was the redheaded stepchild of Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you were really looked down on if you did it. There was a pervasive snobbishness at the Academy about horror. You know, it was like, you know, for God's sake, get out as quick as you can.
Hmm. Well, that's one of the things we would talk about at the master's dinners is how little respect the genre would receive from the mainstream press and industry.
Yes, but now it's the most consistent moneymaker they've got in terms of genre. And that's a whole, that was your opening monologue. But I mean, what they've done something else Hollywood has, they've replaced the movie star with tent poles.
Yep, you with know, IP. Yeah.
They destroyed the star system, which Hollywood was built on. So if you want to know why Hollywood is, you know, in terrible trouble, that's one of the reasons.
Well, what's interesting is that Chucky is now the star. You know, it's not the actor, but the doll that you helped create.
For this Child's Play, a visual memoir book that I just put out, I went back in my files and I found the first iteration of it that I did. And nobody knew even in treatment form, it screamed out to be called Chucky, but nobody would have known who Chucky was. So I named it Child's Play.
Which is a great title, and it became a huge hit that spawned a franchise.
Well, it spawned, nobody could have been more surprised than me. I think the genius, oh Christ, I'm going to sound like a raving idiot. It's when I decided to take a serial murderer and put him inside the doll.
Yep.
And then inside, and then give that doll to an innocent little boy. And that was just so shocking as a concept back at the time. In the time, you know, there was a visceral reaction to it, as though I had destroyed the dream of childhood, you know, the beauty and the safety. And I mean, I got boxes of letters from the UK. It's the reason that United Artists, in a stroke of suicidal tendencies, they sold the sequel rights to Universal.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
After it had been a huge hit, maybe they had made the first Child's Play sequel dropped a lot, and the third one really crashed, I think. Maybe they sold it after that, but they didn't think there was any more life in it when they sold it.
And then along comes Bride of and all the others to follow, and the Chucky TV series.
Well, look at what they've done with Psycho.
Motel.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, in yours, Stefano must have hated 2 and 3 because he ignored them totally in 4.
Well, I think what he wanted to do was make a direct prequel sequel to the original film, because everybody knows the original Psycho.
Yeah.
We know Psycho 2, we know Psycho 3, and appreciate all of that. But for one thing, it's the writer of the original screenplay for Psycho who was brought in to do a prequel sequel. So it may have been his ego or just the idea that I don't know 2 and 3 like I know 1. I was there throughout 1.
And you were there?
No, him. I'm. This is Joe Stefano's thinking.
Okay.
I'm wondering if maybe that was his familiarity, was with the original Psycho, and for him to do an extension of that, I think he just wanted to skip over and go right to the today. Go from before his movie took place and have young teenage Norman Bates, Henry Thomas, whom you've worked with as well. And continue that story.
And then they followed that prequel concept with 2 television series after, right?
Yeah, the Bates Motel TV movie with Bud Cort, and then Bates Motel the series.
Which was terrific, right?
Yeah, but
that was very good.
It didn't have much to do with the idea of who Norman Bates was from the movies. It definitely made a turn. It started out that way, but then it started turning more to drug dealers in high school and things like that, which an unexpected turn.
But can't keep up anymore with the volume coming out, you know?
Who can?
Yeah.
Media is everywhere and it's at our fingertips. You can be anywhere on the planet and tap your iPad and watch whatever you want. Anytime you want. And it makes it disposable and maybe not worth as much. You know, the value of going out to a movie theater and get your parking and pay for your movie ticket and get your snacks, you're invested in what you're going to see. But in terms of media immediacy, it devalues it, I think, to a sense. What do you think?
Just what you said in spades. Underline it 25 times. I'm just thinking, I've come back full circle to acting. I'm in a movie called Tarot, T-A-R-O-T, as an actor, by Peter Higuchi, a very talented filmmaker. And
I know Peter, yeah. In fact, okay. I have a link to the trailer now. I have to check it out.
Okay, good. Please. But I mean, what they're doing today, I mean, the biggest sets in that, like the interior of a church, is all done on LED walls.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, you can see at some point, we're not going to go on location anymore, Mick. I don't know, not in our lifetime, but you can see it coming.
Well, Hitchcock would have been very happy.
Yeah.
He hated going on
holograms.
Yeah, he hated going on location. He loved shooting on stages. He loved sitting in his chair and directing from his chair and not moving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
From what I'm told and what I've read in all the stories.
No, there are a lot. I've heard so many stories. Yeah, a cameraman once she said put a 75 lens on that. The cameraman said, I think it'd be better with a 50, and he was gone in an hour.
I bet he was. Well, that's the wrong director to tell that. Did you ever meet him? I used to see him on the lot at Universal, but only from a distance.
Me too. I'd see him when I was there on, you know, for, you know, going in on readings and acting jobs. And they used to have over on the side near where Barham, I guess, is, they used to have all these little cottages.
Right.
And he had one of them, including his own private dining room and chef. Aaron Spelling had the same setup, you know, anyway.
John Landis moved into Hitchcock's office after he left it.
I love John. One of the best nights I ever had was at Masters of Horror watching Tarantino and John Landis one up each other on trivia. And they finally got into doing box arts on the VHS.
The VHSs, releases.
I said, I'm out of here. I'm gone.
Too much minutiae for you. Yeah.
How did you find working with Tony?
Complex.
This was his last movie.
Well, it was one of his last. It was his last studio film, certainly. He was ill, but at that time he was not admitting to it because we would not have been able to get insurance under the circumstances. And it also painted such a dark brush at a time in our history that was not very generous. He had done Psycho 3 and wanted to do Psycho 4, but Psycho 3 had not succeeded. And so he was assigned this director whose last movie was Critters 2. So we've talked about the challenges of it, but the fact was I learned a lot from him. He was brilliant and prickly. And eventually generous once he trusted me, but I had to earn his trust, and it took a while. And we only had 4 weeks to shoot the movie, so
Shot it in 20 days.
We shot in 24 days, but they were 6 day weeks in Florida on the Orlando lot.
Okay.
So, did you work with Tony at all?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the sense that I was, you know, that I was, I'd written it, and he wanted to talk to me. And I went in and I think I brushed up that, I think for him, I wrote that scene where he talks about toasted cheese sandwiches in the attic with Meg Ryan. But I rewrote that for him. I can't remember, but I know that I did. There were constant complaints about Meg Tilly, one of the most brilliant intellectually brilliant actors that I ever met with, because this, I'm back in trivia again, but I used to be able to name you pretty much any actor in any classic movie. Well, he got bored playing the game, you know, who would name who. And he said, okay, let's change it. Let's do cinematographers and composers.
There you go.
I was gone. I was lost again. Then I found out that he used to play the trivia games all the time with Stephen Sondheim.
And he and Stephen Sondheim wrote The Last of Sheila.
That's right.
Which is a terrific mystery. Very kind of Agatha Christie style.
Anyway, I liked Tony a lot, but I never lost the feeling that it was Norman underneath there.
Well, unfortunately, that was the case with his career as well. You know, it was the best and worst thing that could happen to him. The people could only see him as a version of Norman Bates from then on. And before that, he was a heartthrob. He was
a romantic lead.
Romantic lead. He had hit record. You know, he was a Hollywood heartthrob. And the course of his life changed after Psycho. Some would say for the better, some would say for the worse. But it certainly painted him in a box.
I'd have to ask him why he took it, and I never did. Just to work with Hitchcock, I don't know.
It seems to me the opportunity to be the lead in an Alfred Hitchcock thriller. The only director at the time, other than Frank Capra, who was known by name to the public, must have been an irresistible pull.
Well, I know. Well, who the hell ever knew it was going to work so well? You know, I mean, I don't think I knew what editing and montage was before I saw Psycho. I think I learned after that.
In those days, pre-1960, most directors came from the stage, and they were mostly about working with actors, directing actors. And the reason the cinematographer was called the director of photography was because he designed the shots and he would work with the director and do the technical aspects of it. But Hitchcock, along with a lot of the early silent filmmakers, Hitchcock was a director who was as much about the technology and the physical technique of making a film as he was about performance. And from what I hear from people who worked for him, he rarely ever gave direction to his actors.
Paul Newman hated him. did Torrin Curtin with him. And Torrin Curtin has one of the best kill scenes or death scenes I've ever seen. But he said he'd ask Paul, and Paul would ask him what this was about or that was about. And Hitchcock said, look this way for the count of three and then over here.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all he ever got, you know?
Well, the thing is, to hire actors you trust.
Well, Vera Miles spoke very highly of him. She was heartbroken because she was going to play the Kim Novak part in Vertigo.
Yeah.
And she got pregnant. And Hitchcock got mad at her and didn't forgive her for a long time.
Yeah. Sad stuff, but Hollywood history. Mm. And we've been able to be witness to some of that.
Now, well, something had to be going on with Psycho that it's lasted 40 years, 45, 60 years, I guess, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, 60 years, but making the, I think it was Stefano that came up with the idea of killing Janet Leigh in the shower as your third act break, which was the real shocker in those days.
Yeah, the first act break. Yeah.
Oh, first act break. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. First act. Yes.
Yeah. It's so shocking. Well, I'm interested in your process as a writer. Do you outline everything? Do you sketch everything in, or do you start on page one with an idea and just burn through it? What is your process as a writer? And then we'll talk about as a director.
Oh, God. All of it. I have tried everything. If there's any way to try to write, I've tried it. And if there's any way I failed it, part of me feels like I failed at everything, you know?
You've got a mighty nice house in the hills for having failed at everything.
Well, thank you. I'm writing novels now. I finished The Notch was the first one, and I'm working on Crystal Tower now.
Oh, from that spec script that first got you as a writer.
That also got me an in-house deal with Carolco, and then it was too expensive, and I was trying to kick it down, and then they got in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have these in your life, but it's you're the one who's sort of responsible somewhere back there. When I was between the two Stephen King projects, I think, between Langoliers and Thinner, you said that I should start writing novels because you were.
Yeah.
That always stayed with me. And I after that, I would try periodically. Go ahead.
No, I remember that very well. For me, it was a way to blow off the steam of completing a project. Being done with all of the 16-hour work days and the six-day weeks that were really seven-day weeks. And the idea of just sitting down in front of a keyboard with an idea, no concerns about budgets or egos or schedules or anything like that. And for the love of the language, you're writing a blueprint when you're writing a script, when you're writing a short story or a novel, you're writing a tapestry, you're filling it in, and it's internal as well as external. So the feeling as a writer was incredibly fulfilling in ways that screenwriting can't be unless you're also directing the script.
Well, you said it very, very well. I mean, I will say that it's the old argument. A screenplay is a blueprint for a movie, but it's not the thing itself. A novel is the thing itself.
And when you're a director, you're making the movie. You're not maybe making the movie. Once you're hired to direct a movie, that's a green light. When you're a screenwriter for a movie, you're hoping there will be a movie that comes of this.
Well, that's everybody that we know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's nobody I know that hasn't at one term or another lived in development hell. And I think that that's even getting more. My complaint, you know, you were talking about with streaming and the volume of productions that's coming out. The larger your audience, and it is now going global or worldwide, the more homogeneous your product has to be. In other words, the less it has to have anything in it that's going to upset anybody.
Mm.
Okay. Yeah. So as you make one huge global audience, just one audience, and they're trying to service everybody, you know, all the rough edges and anything that's probably a distinctive voice is pretty much wiped out.
That's a great point. But, you know, because there are so many different streamers and they're so competitive and they don't have advertising. Well, some of them do in their cheaper plans now.
On the way.
Yeah, but they don't have censorship like the networks have censorship. The broadcast networks have censorship. And you'll get a TV version of Dead Ringers, or you'll get something really dark, you know, that you wouldn't have gotten from broadcast or even cable TV. But now they all have to compete with one another. So I think they are competing for the creative minds and those creative people, those creative leaders will seek out the ones who will give them the most freedom. So you have to have muscle to flex, but there at least is a panoply of platforms available to us now that we didn't have in the past.
Okay, good point. I mean, you know, that this is the argument.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it is. At the same time, you know, I'm saying that they're destroying the star system because they don't want to pay, you know, charismatic actors.
Yeah.
But that's the big reason that people have gone to film since the creation of film.
Yeah.
No Charlie Chaplin, no, you know.
If you don't have a cast that draws attention, that an audience can sympathize with, you don't have a movie either. You know, and there's still, you've got Tom Cruise, you've got Brad Pitt, you've got a handful of people who are still nearly reliable movie stars, but even they are not as reliable as they were. You know, there's no guaranteed movie star movie that will absolutely get great box office.
Well, there's something else. The cultural element has been taken out of it. The used to be all our lives that Hollywood movies were soft American power, that they went out and set standards for clothes or, you know, for the car you drove, or whether or not you smoked or whatever. But American cinema has, by and large, lost the hell of a lot of its national, of its American feeling. It's hard to describe, but it used to be the Hollywood made movies for the world.
Yep.
Now Hollywood is making Indian films and it's making European films and, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I like the influence of the the world on world cinema and on Hollywood cinema. And, you know, I see that potentially as a positive. So,
okay.
But let's get back to your process. You know, you say you've done every different kind of approach to writing. In your directing, do you storyboard? Do you shot list? How flexible are you? When, you know, I've seen you work because you did an episode of Amazing Stories, and then you worked for us on Masters of Horror. But the process off the set, what is your prep? Do you like to have everything planned out a la Hitchcock, where it's boring to him to shoot because he's already shot it on storyboards? Or is it a sense of discovery each time you get on a set?
Nah, it's a mixture. Anything that's a visual set piece, which is anything that's suspenseful, I storyboard very, very explicitly. If you get into a big dialogue scene of page and a half, 2 pages, no, not particularly. But if it's somebody creeping around with a knife in their hands, I'm there for every shot. You know, Child's Play was boarded from beginning to end.
Wow.
You know, and I also boarded Fright Night that way. One of the less successful films that nobody ever asked me about is Fatal Beauty with Whoopi Goldberg.
With Whoopi Goldberg, sure, yeah.
And all I was trying to do there was, beyond the action, I was trying to encourage a little bit of improv, hoping for comedy, you know, because it wasn't in the script, but that was her talent, or a lot of her talent back then.
She is so talented. She's been on the show too, and just a total treasure.
She is a brilliant mimic, at least she was at that moment in time. Mm. I mean, she was not it wasn't Elaine May. You know, it wasn't, you weren't getting one-liners, but when she did somebody, you know, I mean, it was incredible.
Did you see her one-woman show before you made the movie?
No, I never did. Hmm. But that's the one that Mike Nichols directed, I think.
Right, yes.
Yes, and I heard it was brilliant.
Yeah, I think they did a version for HBO, but she got The Color Purple by doing that one woman show in the screening room at Amblin for Steven one-on-one.
She did it for him one-on-one?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, I thought Color Purple was just great.
So fantastic and so beautiful. And what an amazing debut performance. I mean, she had to carry that whole movie, and it's her first movie.
Well, Oprah too.
Yeah. Same for Oprah. Mm-hmm. So what was your experience on Fatal Beauty?
It was very, very difficult because I had never done, and you mentioned it earlier, I was starting in daytime and going to all-nighters by the end. And it really was, you could bullshit it, but it really was a 7-day week. It was definitely a 6-day week, yeah. You know, and that ground me up in a way that I mean, in other words, by the end of it, I was really whipped.
How do you deal with that, keeping a cast and crew positive and enthusiastic and willing to kick ass every time they come to the set every day?
Oh, boy. My experience, Mick, is that there's a rise and fall of the movies. You start out with a lot of nervous energy. It sags somewhere towards the middle. And if it's working and if it's feeling right, it picks up as it goes into the end and gets better and it gets faster. But, you know, I had it like that anytime. Anyway, I've also had terrible trouble, you know, like making the doll work in Child's Play. Yeah. Where do you see that? Where do you see the visual memoir? When you see something like 22 puppeteers surrounding me, I look at the pictures and I say, how did I ever do that?
Well, you know? Imagine Gremlins 2, what that must have been like with all the hundreds of puppets.
You imagine?
I can't.
has Joe ever put it down?
I don't think so. But tell me about the process of putting this down, because this is something that's brand new, that's just coming out, your visual history of Child's Play. Tell me about the idea of putting that together into book form.
Well, I didn't. It just kept going. I saw the remake from UA. You know, I wasn't exactly thrilled. And I don't think it's the writer's fault, because obviously they started out to shoot it as a Christmas movie and then pulled back, but it didn't work. So I started looking at, you get a reality working with a real puppet, right? Okay? And especially if the puppet is difficult to work with. I mean, it takes it trying to get the eye line right, you know, while you were moving the body parts. I mean, it was almost every shot was difficult, but some shots worked brilliantly. And so what I was experiencing it while I was making it was, part of me was worried sick about the audience accepting the doll being really capable of being a killer, you know, of being able to move, to hold the knife.
The suspension of disbelief, yeah.
Yes, where you'd have the shot where you could look down on him and you were hiding all the wires coming out of the floor that were making his mouth and eyes and everything else move. But I was constantly looking for, look, Ma, no wires, with those shots that I hope would sell the believability of the doll moving. And Mick, I didn't know until I got into the cutting room. And then I didn't know until I saw the first preview. But what happened from the first preview was the scenes with the doll, the scary scenes with the doll all worked. I mean, but it didn't mean the film worked. I mean, the film was too long. There was, you know, there was a ton of work that got finer and finer as it went along, but
the seams didn't show.
No, a lot of it was about hiding the seams. You know, the same thing with thinner. I knew that I had something when I wrote it, and I put that first treatment in the visual memoir. How did I do it? I put the photos down in the order that I knew I shot them, because I remembered. And then I looked at it, and I found about 150 photos, and I looked at it, but there was no story with it, you know? And then I'm going through my files and everything, and I found the treatment. It's not long, but I found the treatment that I gave to UA before they gave me the green light, before I went and I wrote it. I said, this is what I want to do, because I knew it was so revolutionary putting Charles Lee Ray in there. He's the killer. You know, so, but I mean, I don't know how I did anything. Do you know how you got to this point?
Just opening the doors of opportunity that are offered to me.
Yes, but at the same time, I've made terrible mistakes. I've made bad movies. I fought with the wrong people. I have burned bridges that I shouldn't have burned and everything else. But yet, when I look back on it, I love some of the movies that I made and wrote.
Tell me the best experience you ever had on a movie, making a movie.
Making a movie, Fright Night.
Yeah?
As far as writing a movie and being there beginning to end, Psycho 2. But that's because Richard came in his head with specific sequences of kills, I guess you call them kills now, from Hitchcock's movies that he wanted to replicate in Psycho 2. So the psychiatrist getting stabbed at the top of the stairs is really the detective from Psycho getting stabbed at the top of the stairs.
Arbogast, yeah.
Yeah, but so many moments were taken from Hitchcock's entire oeuvre or whatever it is.
Yeah, and you were able to be there as the writer, seeing it brought to life by a very talented director, and you didn't have to do the heavy lifting.
Of directing it, you mean?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Well, but I mean, I never saw, he had Dean Cundey, who was excellent, and he had a very, very strong group of actors, and the only problem he had was with Tony throwing up a snit fit about Meg Tilly, but it was more than he didn't feel he was getting. You know, actors will bounce when they're in a scene. They'll go off each other moment to moment. He wasn't getting that from her.
Interesting. And she's the female lead. And if you don't have that.
Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, she gave great performances. She gave a whole string of them back then.
Yeah. Agnes, you know, the, of God and all of that. Yeah,
that's right. And her sister's really talented.
Jennifer Tilly, who just happens to be a big part of the Chucky franchise herself.
Mm. Well, she did a film called Bound.
I love that. Yeah.
Okay.
The Wachowski brothers at the time. Yeah.
Now sisters. That's right. But it's an excellent film.
It's really great.
Yes. And I forget the male actor, Italian pants. I forget.
Joey Pantoliano.
Yeah. I think it was him.
Yeah.
But anyway, terrific film. And that's when I first spotted the sister.
Yeah.
So, you know, how did I do? I don't know. How did, you know, I mean, I always think, look, I'm being too honest, but, you know, because I read Richard's memories and he had a tendency to blame his crew and his line producers. Mm-hmm. And you can see it, you know, reading through, you know, movie after movie, what's going on. You know, that in unions, because they always called tea time down in Australia.
Right.
When he needed one more shot. But no, I don't know how we've gotten here.
Who are your heroes? Who are your cinematic heroes?
Oh, my gosh. In our generation?
Of any generation.
Well, Marno. Which I was thinking about. I looked at his silent films with Richard when I was writing Psycho 2, Sunrise.
Yeah,
I think it's the great one. Yeah,
the cinematic silent cinematic art.
Well, I saw everything with Richard because he was really a pedagogue in a lot of ways. I saw everything that Hitchcock had made, and I saw a ton that John Ford had made. Because those were, in Richard's opinion, the two greatest directors.
They were the USC heroes of that era.
Well, that Richard was very USC of that moment.
Yeah.
But then so was Randall, and so was, you know, Star Wars and all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Richard didn't change very much. I like Melville myself. I don't know. I'm reading more now, Mick.
Who are the authors that you really like?
Well, I just read the Sumner Redstone book, Interview, which will really twist your head. There's no fiction to it, but oh my God, for a Hollywood story.
Mm. So you're reading nonfiction more than anything?
But I'm widely read all over the place. I've read fantasy. Brandon Sorensen.
Don't know that.
Yeah, I've read a couple of books. I can't remember names of titles, but California about L.A. gangs.
Mm.
You know, the brown and black gangs and the war going on there. I've read two books on that. So it's a new kind of noir that's coming out.
Yeah,
where there is absolutely no moral judgments whatsoever, just showing you the brutality of it, which is what it seems to be. But that's sort of what you're saying with a lot of movies coming, not movies, but series.
Yeah, there's a lot of nihilism out there. So what is the one project you still hope to achieve? Would it be turning Crystal Tower into a movie?
Crystal Tower, I'm writing it now. I'm 40,000 words in. It is a streaming series, if there ever was one, in my humble opinion. But I walked around for 4 to 5 years with Day of the Triffids. I wrote two excellent scripts on that. When I had the deal set up at Universal, Mark Platt, and they were just scared of the cost of the effects of making the killer plants. Now it's going to turn around and it's going to be, I figure whether it's Amazon or HBO, it's going to be a huge streaming series.
And the BBC already did it as a series.
Was it any good?
It was good. Yeah.
Definitely. That I didn't know.
Yeah.
That's like, Triffids in England is like the high school, the book in high school everybody reads.
Right, exactly. Everybody.
It's part of the culture. Yeah.
Well, Tom, you've had such a tremendous history, a tremendous present, and hopefully Crystal Tower will be more of your future. This hour has blown by. And
amazing, isn't it?
Got to do it again. Yeah, thank you so much for joining me. It's so good to catch up with you.
No, it's just good seeing you because you look really good.
So do you, Tom. I mean, you look
and
fresh.
You got your hair and you got a so big smile on your face. God bless.
Always.
God bless, Mick. And everybody out there who's listening, everybody's got their own journey, but you're gonna end up wherever you want to be.
Awesome. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.